With Spring Black Friday deals at the Home Depot, you can give your lawn or garden beds a pop of color and protection. Right now, get a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10. Help your soil retain moisture longer with color that lasts up to 12 months. Shop Spring Black Friday deals for a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 bags per customer while supplies last.
Welcome to the 7th Brandel Chambly podcast with Jaime Diaz. Brandel is still in his playing career, but he's gracious enough to share some of his wisdom, and that wisdom is increasing as he plays more because his enthusiasm for the game and his depth of curiosity is even greater. So welcome, Brandel. Thanks for being here.
Always great talking to you, Jaime.
Okay, Brandel. Let's talk about something that I know you talked about before, and it's something that's a little under the radar, but it may be one of the more important issues in golf, and that is, how do we evaluate our golf teachers, our golf instructors? There are ratings in magazines. There's certainly word of mouth. There's all kinds of subjective ways, and it's going to be subjective in the end, just like a university professor would be. At the same time, it's very hard to measure results in golf, and we see a lot of people dropping out of the game early because it's too difficult. And we see a lot of great players regressing sometimes with more teaching. So this is not to knock teachers. There's nothing better than a great teacher. But what in your mind is the issue here in terms of evaluating the golf instruction today and whether it's, you know, valuable or actually a detriment?
Yeah, I think the industry itself, and I'm not just talking about the PGA of America, because there are a great many teachers who are not members of the PGA of America. I don't know what the PGA of America can do to sort of bring those teachers into the fold, so to speak. But they're missing out a lot on not having some of the more prominent teachers in the PGA of America. But they do have, I think, the ability, and they're not using it, to find out who the very best teachers are. And it should never be, or I should say, it should only narrowly be about subjective behavior. Of course it matters, the demeanor of a teacher and how well they get along with their students and so forth. Those things matter, but it should be, because the game of golf would get better if we found out who was having the most success teaching beginning golfers, let's say, and college golfers and tour pros, even at the tour pro level. And I'll give you an example, because the tests that I'm talking about have been done there to some extent. A company by the name of Data Golf, I believe, looked at 39 swing coach changes on the PGA Tour going back to 2004. And they measured the player's ability before meeting those coaches and after, 1 year after, and 2 years after, to find out which players were better immediately after working. And most players get better immediately after working with somebody. It's attributable to, you know, the placebo effect to some degree, and the fact that they were seeking instruction because their game was in the tanks. But who sustained a level of improvement over a year and 2 years? And what they found was very few players did. Now, is that and very few coaches of the coaches, you know, 39 swing coach changes is not a small number. It's not as big a number as you'd like, but it's not a small number. And they only found that two coaches actually had players better 2 years after working with them. Only two. and so you realize, to me, it's like, well, I would like to know who the best coaches are. I see those lists that the various periodicals put out. And I know for sure those are not the 50 best coaches in the country. I know for sure they're absolutely not. It's just too coincidental that they're the most visible. So I get it. If you're in that business and you have coaches on your staff, you want to elevate their cachet and deem them to be these great coaches. But I would really like to know who the best coaches are. This would be like having a race and not having time, and they're running all the laps, and they all finish at different times, and you don't know who the fastest runner was. You have no idea. This would be like us sitting around discussing the best golfer without keeping score. Like, well, I don't know. That one was smiling. That one looked really good. That one was signing a lot of autographs. That one was really good. Did you see the social media posts that Phil Mickelson? I think Phil's the best golfer. He's got the best social media posts. I think Phil Mickelson is the best golfer in the world. That is what we're doing in the teaching world. That's how we assign the best teachers in the world. And it's a bunch of crap. It's crap. I go online. I look at the best teachers in the world, what they say are, and I look at their lessons. And they're wrong. Most of them are wrong. And I would like to know, and the way to do that is to objectively judge teachers before and after with every single student. And if a teacher doesn't want to do it, fair enough, but I think the PGA of America could go, look, if you want to be picked out as our, you know, if you want to be eligible for the top 50 teachers of our 29,000, there's 29,000 of them. You can't tell me that those 50 in the magazines are the best of those 29,000. If you want to be eligible for our highest honor, to be our best teachers, here's what has to happen. When a student comes to you, they have to have a handicap. That handicap is measured. And then after you work with them, their handicap is measured still against their old. There's a before and after. You do this with every one of your students. We would find somebody who's having tremendous success with all level of students. And then the industry would beat a path to that door and find out what are they doing. My guess is that teacher would be teaching in a much more holistic way. They would be taking them out on the golf course, and it would be more situational. It would be more old school. You could also use metrics off of the various radar devices. Who's got the biggest increase in clubhead speed of all these different levels of players? Who's got the smallest dispersion rate on these radar? Who is the best improvement in wedge combine? You've got tons of metrics that
we never had before.
We never have before, and it's available. And I do this not to call out or put a spotlight on those that are not having success. That's not the point of this. The point is, it's not to embarrass anybody. It's to improve the game, improve the teaching. How? Because we would find out, how is this person? There would be 50 people, 100 people that are having tremendous success that are not stars in the game.
And put the spotlight on them.
And we would put the spotlight on them. And you know what then? When I saw that list in the magazines, I would not only read it, I would call them. I would reach out to them. Even now, I go online and I do the best I can at looking who has the most success objectively. I look at teachers online. I look at their students. I go into the data. I determine who's having the most success. This is the reason I flew to London to go see James Ridyard. I've looked at the before and after of Francesco Molinari around the greens. I know what he was and I know what he is. And I'm thinking, well, what the heck happened? You dig a little deeper. You find out he's working with James Ridyard on the short game. I go online, and James Ridyard is a savvy guy. You can get a little of what he knows, but to get the whole thing, you have to buy all of his website stuff, which I did. I paid for all of it, went online, looked at all of it. But I wanted to know more, so I flew to London. I arranged to meet him. I spent the day with him, and I'll go spend another day with him. I did the same thing with George Gankus. I did the same thing with Lucas Wald. I found them on social media, on YouTube, on the internet, and then I looked at their metrics. Are they making players better or worse? I was curious, so I flew to meet them. But there's another 50, 100, 1,000. Who knows how many there are? Imagine all of the great ideas you have in that 29,000 group of people, and then probably another 5,000 who are not PGA of America members. The best minds are not being sought out. The best ideas are not being sought out. They're being tsunamied by those with more polished PR skills or better rhetoric, better at social media. And that's fine. I get that. I mean, you got to get, and I'm not belittling those that have had success at that at all. I mean, that's your job, is to go out and make a living and put your name out there, and more power to you. It's just that I'm interested in the success of ideas. And I think golf would be much, much better at the – look, I can name you dozens of players that played the game at the highest level that have become vastly diminished because of the lessons they've taken. If the best players are struggling to find great help, what chance does the amateur have? Or what are the odds that the amateur's getting the best help?
Or a beginner especially, getting off on the right foot.
Right. And mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the things that's, you know, I said in the last podcast that the game is not better than it was. It's worse off than it was in a lot of ways. In some ways it's better, but it's worse off in that the corporatization of the game has meant that they only look at the game as a bottom-lined endeavor. How much money am I going to make? Golf should never be about profit. It's a nonprofit sport. Mm-hmm. The money goes back into the club. It goes back into hiring the best personnel. It should never be about profit, unless you're in the club making business, you know. But you're running a club, for the members. Yeah. And I want the best professional possible. And that means a person who's on the range, who's talking to the players, shaking hands, fixing a grip here, going out and playing, you know, nine holes with the ladies on Thursday and the guys on Saturday morning or whatever it is, and promoting golf.
That's wonderful.
Now then, because of the corporatization of golf and the bottom line is all that matters, they hire people that have less experience playing the game and more experience at bottom line endeavors. Well, it's killing golf. And so they don't realize that they're cannibalizing their own endeavor. It's like, who is the most important person in golf? It's not the tour pro. It's the club pro. The club pro is the most important person in golf. That is your first connection to the game. It was mine.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it was yours.
You're not the first to say it. Jackie Burke's been saying it. Okay. He's almost 95 years old.
And Jackie Burke's a smart man. It was mine. Yeah. And if that head pro hadn't known how to tell me to hold a putter or hadn't made my life, you know, wonderful and comfortable to be at the golf course all day and been the great head professional that he was, I would be probably doing something else in my life.
I had a similar experience. Yeah. Well, not as profound as yours, but definitely.
Right. It's not to say there are not great pros out there. There are amazing pros out there.
Of course, but let's find out who they are and why they are.
But I know people leave, very competent people leave the PGA of America program or leave the game to go do other things. You know, I had a buddy of mine he went and sat down in a meeting for a head pro job, and they said, you know, you got to run the shop, you got to buy this, you got to hire employees, you got to, you know, do the food and beverage, you got to do all this, blah, blah, blah. As he sat there, he was listening, and he was like, you know what? I don't want the job. And they said, what do you mean you don't want the job? And he goes, it just occurred to me, if I can do all those things, what the hell would I do this job for $42,000 a year for?
Yeah.
I can do all those things you said. Well, I thought this was a golf pro job. You know, I thought I was being asked.
Career.
I thought I was going to go play golf. I thought I was going to teach golf, work with golfers, be out on the golf course, be on the driving range, promote golf. You want me to just promote your golf shop and make more money for you. That hurts the game. It hurts the game at every single level. There's still plenty of great club professionals, and the PGA of America is an amazing program, but it could be better.
Yeah. I'm going to see Seth Waugh next week. I'm going to recommend that he spend
Seth
a few
Waugh
minutes
a,
listening.
Seth Waugh is a smart man.
He's a brilliant guy.
He really is.
And I think he's open-minded. Yeah, and I think one of the reasons he took this job, because he certainly didn't need to do it, give back to the game and bring the best ideas that he can to it.
Well, he would understand, you know, more than anybody probably, because he comes from the corporate world. I mean, he would understand how to, in a sort of a retroactively way, sort of a going back to the roots of the game, improve the game.
He's very much a romantic and traditionalist about golf. So while he knows how corporations work as well as anyone probably, he also doesn't want to get lost in the pitfalls of corporate life when it comes to golf.
Yeah, there was a club, Bailey and I went and played in a couples event in Arkansas, and it was great fun. But you know, when we were there, you could tell that the club was, you know, cutting corners here or there. Well, that club just went out of business.
Yeah.
And they're building homes on that golf course, and come to find out, it was owned by someone who was worried about the profit. So the meal service went down, the cutlery and plates and staff were cut, and people quit going to the club to eat, to hang out, to play golf, you know, and the club's gone. And it's just one of many, because they were worried about profits. Again, clubs should make money only to improve the experience for the golfers. And then, you know, what do the golfers do? They travel to other places mm-hmm. to play golf at resorts. Now, that's a different animal. They go to resorts.
And there should be a public subsidy for the for the public service, you know, that golf courses like, should provide.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you. It's a very rich subject, and I'm sure we'll return to it. But I'm guessing it's going to have some impact when it goes out here, because a lot of people have not considered this to the same extent you have, and I think it's going to open some minds. Let's talk about distance. We touched on it in the last podcast as something that affects style of play, that affects the product on the PGA Tour, that affects the way golfers are learning, and maybe affects the quality of golf. Mm-hmm. Because it's wonderful to see people hit it as far as possible. We have long drive contests. It's always something in every sport. You want to see power. You want to see dunks in basketball. You want to see long home runs in baseball. You want to see the bomb in football. And yet, if it becomes sort of one-dimensional, it's not actually something that improves the game, because it makes it monotonous and it takes mm-hmm. away some of the nuance that we actually end up, as we become golfers, loving more than just the raw power and distance. I'm not knocking long and straight, but we talked about distance becoming so predominant, certainly in the elite game, and to the point where the ruling bodies and very influential people are starting to question whether it's something that needs to be reined back. You talked about bifurcation the last podcast. This is an endless subject. We're just going to scratch the surface today, I think. But tell me, you know, there is some noise out there now. It's subtle. It's under the surface, but it's coming. You can feel it bubbling up. The USGA and the RNA have the Distance Insights Project, which some people poo-pooed because it looked like bureaucracy and, you know, just sort of an empty study.
Well,
but
they couldn't just do it willy-nilly.
No, and they're really trying to, you know, vet as much as possible the entire holistic group of influencers to make sure that nobody has any objections that we didn't have a voice in all this.
Yeah.
They're taking their time. They've got the information now, but they also are writing the report. So it's due out in November. We saw Martin Slumbers at mm-hmm. Port Rush. You talked to him, I know. Mike mm-hmm. Davis has made some comments. He's been more cautious because I think the USGA is always under the scrutiny and can be criticized most easily. But also Fred Ridley, the chairman of the Augusta mm-hmm. National and the Masters, has made, I think, some pretty influential comments if you read between the lines. So tell me where you see this right now in terms of something happening, or if it's not happening, should it be?
Well, I think Martin Slumbers was more transparent in his remarks on our set on Live From. The actual words bifurcation didn't come out of his mouth. The actual words rolling the ball back, we are going to roll the ball back, didn't come out of his mouth. But reading between the lines, that's what he said. He certainly hinted at it very strongly. And it would be great for golf. Mike Davis hasn't been that forthcoming, but Chairman Ridley, I think in his remarks at the Masters, again, in a soft way, said, you guys need to get your act together. I think his words were something along the line, we're going to wait and see what the governing bodies do, but the shot at 13 is no longer momentous. The second shot into 13, of course, those are famous words by, you know, Bobby Jones, is that we feel that the second shot at 13 should be a momentous one. And, you know, I go back and I compare the second shot that Sergio hit at 15 in 2016. He hit an 8-iron to the front pin. It was frontish middle. And he hit the pin. And everybody says it's an amazing shot. And I think, well, not really. And by the way, you don't have any angst hitting an 8-iron over a lake. Jack Nicklaus in 75 hit a 1-iron. And you have a lot of angst hitting a 1-iron over a lake to a pitched green. And the momentous decision needs to be brought back, not just to those holes, but those are, I think it's ironic that Augusta National will play probably the biggest role in bifurcating the game and rolling the golf ball back. And that seems somewhat fitting, doesn't it? I mean, the golf course is so important to all of us. And to the game, it's just, you know, it represents the height of perfection, and And in their own way, they've become great custodians of the game, great promoters of diversity in the game. It's amazing that not being a governing body, how influential they've been. And his remarks are, the shot is not momentous. Even though for years we talked about wedges being hit into that green and how that's not what the architect had in mind. You're meant to be much further back with a hanging lie hitting a long iron or a four wood and trying to figure out how to cut it off a hook lie into that green that demands a cut. And the ball should be rolled back. There should be bifurcation. Now, 5, 6, 7 years ago, I argued for bifurcation as it related to the anchoring band and for other elements in the game because I thought it just made perfect sense. Every other sport is bifurcated. Golf should be bifurcated. It took what's happened in the game since then to make people sort of wake up. I thought if you're not going to bifurcate, then at least make changes in the way you set up a golf course and the way you design golf courses. Because I think, you know, golf course architecture has been stuck in the ideas of 110, 20 years ago, to some extent with the fairways and angles. I'm a fan of the placement of bunkers in the right where you want to go. There's not enough of that. You know, I think well-placed pot bunkers right where you want to go. We don't really have pot bunkers in this mm-hmm. country, but they'll shut you down in a hurry, and they'll make you think. You know, you go to Great Britain, and you play some Lynx golf, and you realize what a nuisance pot bunkers are, but my gosh, they're in your mind, and they're there at every single distance level. I mean, wherever you're going to hit the golf ball, whether it's because what happens over there is because the turf is so firm and the wind conditions are so capricious that they have bunkers at 330.
Because you can reach them downwind.
Because you could reach them 100 years ago downwind. Mm-hmm. So they've got bunkers at 330. So the golf courses stand up to some extent, at least in terms of making you think off the tee. Certainly Royal Lytham does. But even those golf courses need to be updated to some extent if you're not going to bifurcate. And I thought that golf could sort of correct itself with a proper study of the dispersion rates of longer hitters. In other words, roughly 45, 50 yards longer off the tee, those dispersion rates. And because you're coming out of the rough with a faster club head speed, steeper angles, higher trajectories, you could then have a height of rough that mm-hmm. is more penal than it was in the 70s and 80s to sort of combat the problem. You could do it with a proper study. That wasn't going to happen because the most powerful players in the game play the game with reckless abandon, and they were not going to sit idly and let you make them a little less relevant by making it more important to drive it in the fairway.
And the tours probably did not want to, well, you know, inhibit those.
They would just get
those kind of stars.
They would get a different group of stars. You would get a star who is not as tall and not as fast. You would get a different star. You know, there's two great things about golf that should be protected at all costs. Golf is about sort of a long walk with friends, mm-hmm. the camaraderie of the game. First and foremost, that's what golf is to me. Secondly, it's a thinking game. You should have to think the whole day. It's a problem-solving game. You're on every tee, winds off the left, it's whole dog legs to the right. It's 250 to the turn. I could drive it over the corner, but I'm going to go into a pop bunker. I want to hold something up against that wind. My hybrid, I can't draw it as well. I can trap my 2-iron or 3-iron, whatever. You're problem solving the whole day. If you stand up on that same tee, and the reason I described a whole scenario of the first tee at Oak Hills in San Antonio. Mm-hmm. It's where they used to play the Texas Open. And I go there and I'll play with Jimmy Walker or Cameron Beckman. And I, you know, I played that hole in the 80s. And that hole has always been about problem solving. It's a little cute little dog leg left. And I get up there and they pull driver out and they blow it over the corner.
Yeah.
And I get it up in the traps in the front of the green. So the problem is solved with power.
Yes.
And it's not cognitive. It's about power. Now, to offset that, you'd have to design a completely new hole or you would have to put pot bunkers in front of that green that are a shot penalty.
Yes.
That are they couldn't get out of. And then you would make them think about whether or not to do it. And you'd have to strategically place those bunkers to where it would give them a chance to do it still and entice them into doing it so that it would cause them problems and not let them just play the game with reckless abandon. So there are lots of ways to come at the problem. The easiest way is to bifurcate and roll the ball back 30 yards, and golf's better.
And I do recall you years ago and talking to you, I didn't know you as well, but you know that you thought it, you know, the as architects often talk about, the angles and the things that are, you know, wonderful for connoisseurs about of the golden age of golf, that create all these decisions supposedly for even the best players would be the antidote to this. But those solutions were with the presumption that you're hitting a mid iron or something longer into the green, and the wedge or the sand wedge negates all those angles with spin and height.
Yeah, angles could still be done. You would have to be, you know, much more judicious in your narrower angles and placement of bunkers. It could still be done, but the idea of really wide fairways, and then having intricate designs of greens that reward one side of the fairway or the other, it sounds wonderful.
Exactly.
It's the way the game was played 120 years ago when golf was really hard and made it a thinking man's game. I guess if the ball is rolled back 30 yards, then sure, those are going to be more relevant. But those designs do not work in this era. They don't work at all. It has to be more about punishment of a poor shot beyond having a lesser angle.
It's not strategy. It's the penal. Penal philosophy.
You have to get in their face and say, sure, you hit driver here. It's not that you're not going to have an angle. It's that you are going to be in a pot bunker where you may not even be able to get out of it. And then if you do get out of it, then you will have a bad angle. The punishment has to fit the crime. And if you're going to relegate the thoughts of the architect as irrelevant,
you're committing a crime.
Then you need to get slapped by that architect.
Right.
And it's like, listen, I thought long and hard about this. You are not going to make my thoughts irrelevant. So the punishment has to be. The problem is they run into members who are like, well, I can't get out of that bunker. But those same members go to Scotland or Ireland or, you know, England, and they play these golf courses with pot bunker. They call them, they're great, they're cute. They'll sit in a bar and talk about how amazing those bunkers are and how they laugh at their buddy who got in this one, couldn't get out.
It's a novelty, though.
It's a novelty, but it's not. That's what makes golf
no,
great.
No, I'm with you.
They're better designed golf courses over there. Now, granted, the turf rolls out, so it's a little easier to do.
I'm just saying they're laughing because it's a novelty to them. But no, if they understood perhaps the real spirit of it.
Yeah, you tell me a very punishing pot bunker in this country.
Mm. Well, maybe.
Besides at Pine Valley. Okay, and that's the only one anybody can throw out. But nobody gets to play Pine Valley.
No. Yeah.
Okay, then there's one. You tell me another one.
Well,
nobody can off the top of their head. Mm-hmm.
You know? Maybe at Sand Hills there's a couple.
Okay.
Where Crenshaw went. But again, very remote and very much in the spirit of St. Andrews.
I just played Roll Lithium. I can tell you about 200 pot bunkers. Even St. Andrews, I can tell you about pot bunkers there. Or bunkers around the green that you literally can't get out of.
Let me say something I think that needs to be said, which we're talking about rolling the golf ball back and term bifurcation. And believe me, that's the third rail when it comes to the golf leadership discussing this issue, because that creates a tremendous amount of controversy and a tremendous amount, and I think in their mind, of argument that is counterproductive right now. So they're holding those things in abeyance until the time comes. I don't say we shouldn't be talking about them. I'm only saying nobody, when they're talking about distance solutions, bifurcation is something that is considered a little bit obscure and extreme, and rolling the golf ball back is something that has caused Sturm and Drang for all sorts of people, especially the USGA or anybody who could be sued by ball manufacturers. So those, I'm not saying those things aren't on the table. I think they're under the table right now for the moment.
Yeah.
But the point being, they have also, I say, and I think this is a backdoor way perhaps to getting at a solution that'll be more palatable. And things like, you know, water usage and slow play and the footprint of the golf course in terms of, you know, mm-hmm. land use, mm-hmm. and all sorts of things that have nothing to do with actual playability or the skill of the game, just simply the practicality of golf, that the game would be better if the ball went less distance for whatever reason. And what do you think of that approach? Know it doesn't really deal with the elite part of the game, but is it practical?
I thought at the highest level, and Paul Azinger made this point yesterday, I thought it was a great point, that you didn't really have to go design longer golf courses. They were out there. You could just go use them instead of not using them. But, you know, in my estimation, if they weren't going to roll the ball back, then the only solution to the problem was longer golf courses with more penal rough, not narrower fairways. I'm for wider fairways, but only to the extent that it makes sense with dispersion, longer golf course, and then you could at least adequately test the professionals. The game would be bifurcated in some sense, is that nobody really going to play those holes six, or those tees. You wouldn't want to do that. But if they do bifurcate, then the game is in this beautiful sweet spot. And I can understand if I were in the business to make a better ball or club, I'd be upset at bifurcation. But the balls all go the same distance now anyway. And those that are prominent as leaders are still leaders. And when they roll the ball back for professionals, they're all going to go the same distance again. And they're still going to be the same people that lead in the ball count are still going to lead in the ball count. They're not going to lead. There's brand loyalty. People like the sound of one ball versus another. They like the look of one ball versus another. It is much ado about nothing.
I happen to agree, but you will get opponents in the industry who will.
Of course. And if I were in the industry, I would come up with metrics and arguments because in their mind,
it's
they spend
expensive
a lot.
To change. A lot of R&D, a lot of things.
But if they truly do love the game and they realize that it should be, I've sat in those meetings with those executives of those companies. And one of the questions posed to me was, well, when would you like to roll the ball? To what era? To what data? Mm-hmm. You know, at what point did you think the game was perfect? And my answer was, well, I don't know, but a one iron is more along the lines of what the architect had in mind at 15 than an 8 iron. And you will never convince me that Sergio Garcia could hit the ball from a comparative standpoint as far as Jack Nicklaus. Jack Nicklaus was much longer than Sergio Garcia, comparatively speaking, and he had a one iron to the green.
In those days, the Sergio Garcias were laying up on 15.
They were laying up.
Not all of them, but I mean,
unless the conditions were
right. Sergio was pretty long, but Jack was monster long.
Jack was monster long. Jack was Tiger long. So, yeah, that will do. Okay, that era will do. The era that you've deemed the best era of golf, the 70s. Yeah, I agree with you. You made a good argument. So yeah, that'll do. That'll do just nicely. And let's keep it there. If you bifurcate, let's keep it there. Okay, so then what will happen is we can accurately judge the improvement or the impoverishment of the game or the athlete. You know, these guys are better than those guys, or these girls were better than those girls. We could accurately then judge. And it would be more about the athlete and less about the equipment. Now when you watch, you think, well, are they really, is it, you know, is it the driver, is it the irons, is it the 64-degree wedge, which, you know, I don't have any problem with that. You know, people think that you should not allow a wedge with any more loft on it. I'll listen to the arguments. I don't agree with them, because if you have a 64-degree wedge in your bag, you're missing out somewhere, okay? You have a gap somewhere else that you have to deal with, and it's a problem. You have to make up for that gap somewhere else. But yes, bifurcation would be great for golf. I said it 5, 6, 7 years ago. Nothing has changed me of that opinion.
And I would say, you know, I come at it from the perspective of a sports fan who loves sports. I know golf probably better than other sports, but I certainly, as you do, watch a lot of sports and think about what makes that game good and what makes the product great. And athletes evolve. Strategies evolve, and big-time sports, baseball, football, basketball, adjust. Their leadership adjusts on the fly because they know they're in a really competitive environment, and they just can't have a boring sport. They have to have a sport that not only is entertaining to watch, but tests the best athletes in a way that the best athletes win. I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. And when you start in golf feeling like, okay, these guys are great, as you say, lean and stronger than in the past, but perhaps don't have the same skill level through the bag, I think you start to wonder, are they actually the best players being benefiting from the current situation? And I think you can make an argument that the most skillful guys through the bag don't always get rewarded like they did in past eras. The more powerful players with a modicum of skill in other areas, and I would put, you know, and I'm going to catch heat from Brooks now because I have a lot of respect, and I think he's really well-rounded, especially for a guy who's a number one player of this era. More well-rounded than his than Rory or DJ, and that's what separates him from them. But still, not without with the genius that you would see in a Luke Donald or Trevino or any era, or even Tom Watson or Seve. That art is kind of fading, and it's not being asked of the players. So I would love to see the leadership impose changes that ask those questions to bring out the art more, as you see in the NBA, as you see in football, as you see in baseball. Baseball's got issues now with slow play and a lot of things, mm-hmm. and they're suffering for it mm-hmm. right away because they're under the microscope, and as a result, you know, people are going, you know, that's not as good a game as it used to be because they're much more critical. They're much more used to the game being legislated by the leadership. Mm-hmm. Golf's been slow in that regard, and as a result, you know, we are slow on the uptake to pick out things that are lacking in the game. And when someone like yourself, with a lot of credibility, and Jack Nicklaus has been talking about it for 30 years now, almost 40, about, you know, we're missing the boat a little bit here, folks. People think, well, you know, you're just talking about your era and you want everything to go back. Well, yeah, he wants it to go back, not so he can win. He's too old now. Yeah. He wants it to be for the good of the game.
Yeah.
So I think all these things we're talking about are well overdue, but the politics of golf and the administration and the slow to act sort of normal that is golf has, I think, hurt the game.
Yeah, well said. You know, to say that Jack wanted to go back to his era, I think misses the boat. You're not saying that, but other people do say that. He's like an old man. It was better in my day. He's not talking about from a nostalgic standpoint. He's talking about it from a protective standpoint, that the nature of this game was more cognitive than physical, and now it's far more physical than it is cognitive. And that's not why you play the game. I mean, you know, it's getting closer to deadlifts in the gym. You know, who can lift the most weight wins. Well, who the hell wants to see that? I don't want to see that game. I want to see problem solving. I want to see a game of chess with athleticism. Now, that is the perfect game. I'm certainly not an expert on other sports. I don't watch other sports at all, not any of them. But I read about them. Mm-hmm. I read about them in trying to find analogies and parallels to golf. And what I read about baseball is that the strategic nature of it has changed quite a bit, and the radar devices have encouraged batters to hit more up on it. So they're hitting more home runs, and they're also striking out more. And there are a lot of those things that people are not thrilled with. Mike, I don't really worry about that. I look at those games differently. Those games are not games for a lifetime. They're meant to and depend upon the popularity of the actual professional aspect of it. There couldn't be any more different than golf, mm-hmm. okay? The way people treat those games, and it's a popularity contest. It has nothing to do, in my view, of golf. Golf is different. Golf's not a popularity contest. You protect this game because it's a game for a lifetime. Everybody plays golf.
I would argue with you that there are purists in those other games who want to protect what they...
Sure,
and
absolutely.
You know, and I think the perspective you played golf at the highest level. You understand these things you want to protect very intimately. You didn't play the other sports at that level. I didn't play any of them at that level, but I just sort of feel connected to them and appreciate the purists in each one of them.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I think it isn't a game for the lifetime as golf is, which is the beauty of the game. But if you're talking about bifurcation, those players who played for a lifetime are not going to be playing at the highest level either. The highest level is a shorter window. Obviously, it goes on into, you know, Champions Tour and all those things.
But professional golf is a small part of this game. It is every part of, almost every part of every other game. Who plays football at 32?
Unless you're a professional football player,
nobody. Who plays baseball at 32?
Tom Brady just signed another two-year contract. Right. He's going to be 43. Right.
Yeah, they're very nobody except professional athletes. Yeah. this game is more about the people that play it than the professionals. The professionals are very small. There's
no, but
there's 500 of them.
But when we're talking about bifurcation, we're talking about to the benefit of the professional game. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so
I want that game to be better, because that game is more interesting. No question about it. Mm-hmm. Because that is closer to the game that the amateur plays. You know, the amateur does have to consider how to get around obstacles.
Sure. All identify.
Yeah.
You know, it's wonderful.
But so when the amateur watches professionals, they're like, I don't know what game that is. That's not the game I play. Now, even eons ago, they could probably say the same thing about Jack. But at least Jack had to think about obstacles. And, you know, I want our stars to be thoughtful people. Mm-hmm. And the only way to ensure that is to make the game more thoughtful. And then you will have people who come along who play the game who have to be more thoughtful.
And I think you could argue that the same people will still be on top, but they'll be fuller dimensioned players. And they'll be more fun to watch.
No, I don't think the same people will be on top at all.
I don't know if that's true. I'm just saying it's very possible. I think if you're that good an athlete and you love the game that much, you can adapt.
I mean, if the game changes and it's more about, you know, 2+2 and less
about... If you're long and right now you're not feeling the pressure to be that straight, you still have that ability and that speed. And if you're dedicated enough, you can make yourself straighter.
If the game becomes more about patience and intellect.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jack, as you know, he learned to hit it as far as he could first, and then he refined it as he got older. He, in microcosm, that could be what happens to...
I'm only saying that, you know, I know is the game would be better.
I totally agree.
It would be better to watch.
I just don't like the argument that, hey, we're going to change the game, so now you're going to be outmoded. I don't think that's necessarily true. The challenge is there. Tom Watson was wild. He got straighter. Great players adapt. Not all of them. Seve didn't adapt. But I think when you do adapt and you do refine...
Well, no, Seve, it wasn't that Seve didn't adapt. It was that Seve tried to conform.
True.
And that's what ruined Seve.
Well, that's a good point.
So
when he went to Mac and he started shortening his swing. Yeah.
Seve was an artist and he tried to become an engineer. And he lost his genius. And, that's a
different question.
Well,
I understand.
But the game, it didn't mean that, you know, Seve didn't play a bomb and gouge game because his game was far more about the trying to get out of trouble. You know, there was trouble. He couldn't get out of trouble. He had to work his way around trouble. He had to recover. The game's not about getting out of trouble now. It's about really more about how far you hit it and can you just develop a little wedge shot. And that's kind of what the game is.
That's my issue. It's as simple as there's too many wedges. You know,
too many wedges.
That's all. I just want to see some six irons. It's just more. And we do see it at the more difficult major championships when the rough is that penal.
Well,
unfortunately, it takes
the
driver out of the hand, but you have to.
You didn't even see it at Bethpage. You know, I mean, you didn't even see it. I mean, we would have seen it if, you know, somebody was leading who didn't hit it 350. But, you know, even on the holes that were 500 yards, he was hitting driver wedge to them. And so it's like then you think, well, gosh, what would you have to do to get it to where he's hitting driver 4-iron?
Right.
Just roll the ball back.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the rough is a real
So now with the middle iron, the rough's a big deal.
So the rough's a big deal.
Yeah.
So finding the fairway is a much bigger deal.
Yes.
So
totally with
so you swing differently.
Yeah.
You will quit. We have an epidemic of jumpers now. They jump. They jump off the ground. And the reason they jump is they're trying to hit it as far as they can. So the golf swing would change. You'd have guys who rotate. And they'd have a blend of lateral, rotational, and vertical elements in the golf swing, and a lot less jump.
That's subtle.
And they'd have to think more.
And we've celebrated, or I've certainly seen it, where the jumping is celebrated. You know, that's.
I mean, it's just here right now.
Yeah,
it's
but guys
are jumping.
And they're jumping because they can get away with it. It's okay.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because it's all about power.
Yeah.
So jump. So you know the secrets for power are, you know, I think, you know, Matt Wolf I think illuminates these perfectly. You know, you get he's moved, you know, Cameron Champ. You know, you get a bigger turn, okay? He's got away from this restricted turn, but you get a bigger turn, then you squat, and then you jump. And you know, how do you get a dumbbell off the ground? You squat and you jump. You know, you go up and you go down.
It's athletic, but it's not about control.
It is to some extent, but the equipment makes it a lot easier.
That's the other. There's so many variables. That's what makes this discussion so interesting. And I'm going to give Brooks Koepka credit because I know statistically he's not the straightest driver, but I would bet his dispersion is not bad. You know it better, but I sort of feel like when he's got to get a ball, especially at a major championship.
It really doesn't matter. His dispersion, he's not amongst the leaders there.
No, right? I don't mean he's a leader, but he's...
Brooks is amazing to watch. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's amazing. I you know, look, he's got a hell of a golf swing, just a hell of a golf swing. There's elements I don't like, but for the most part, it's like Hal Irwin's golf swing with 20 miles an hour more club head speed. I mean, that's crazy. And his ability to perform in big moments and play in the biggest moments is it's an enigma. You know, you just don't see it coming. I mean, you say, well, majors brought the best out in Tiger. Yeah, they did, but every event brought the best out in Tiger. He won other events just as prolifically, and so did Jack. So here comes this guy, and maybe he'll start winning other events as prolifically.
Maybe
he did at Memphis. Mm-hmm. He's leading, as we sit here and talk, he's leading the FedEx Cup. He's never played particularly well at the Tour Championship. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he's had 1 6th place finish, 28th out of 30, and 16th, I think, or 18th. So he and played well there. So maybe he'll sustain this golf to the FedEx Cup, and that'll be great. You know, that'll be great. It'd be great to see his golf more than 4 or 5 times a year. And that's he'll become less of an enigma if he does that. And a bigger star.
Yeah.
Much, much bigger star. I mean, right now he looks like the man who's like Daniel Day-Lewis, essentially, you know? I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis is a heck of a star, but when do you see him?
Right.
You know, he does a movie every 5 years, and then he wins the Academy Award for Best Actor. Then he disappears for 4 or 5
years.
And
now he's walked away permanently.
Right?
Unfortunately, like, I don't want to see that with Brooks.
It's like, I would rather see him more like Tom Cruise, you know? Make a movie a year, for crying out loud.
I think he's taking that as a challenge. He knows that he has
I think
not.
He has, too.
Yeah. You know, we need to wrap this up, and I just want to say I do feel there is momentum heading towards these things that we've been talking about. It may not be imminent, but it's happening, and I look forward to the game in those years. I think it's absolutely unavoidable that something has to happen.
The whole game will stand up
and
applaud
if the
governing bodies do this. Now, I say the whole game. There will be manufacturers
of course.
That not. But for the most part, people who play the game will go, all right, then we're on.
And I think the argument's gone on for so long, and for a long time it was like, come on, everybody wants to hit the long, you know.
Yeah.
What are you guys talking about? This.
Yeah.
And I think gradually it has
gotten
root that this is something that's actually good.
It would be great, because it would be, I think, at the end of this, if it does happen, rightly lauded would be Nicklaus, Chairman Ridley, the 13th hole at Augusta National.
Yeah, the wise man.
Martin Slumbers.
Yeah,
because Martin is
well, let me read your quote from him. Yeah.
Unafraid.
Yeah.
To get up there and say, this is the way
he said it, I think, in a very smooth, politic way, but there's a lot of substance. And this is just one quote that he had, and this was in 2018. There's no doubt in my mind that the technology has made this difficult game just a little bit easier. At a time when we want more people to play the game, I think that's a good thing. Again, he's talking about the masses. But we also think that golf is a game of skill and should be reflective of skill. If you look at the data, there has been a significant move across all tours in terms of distance. We're looking at the longest on record average driving distance. Both of those have caused us and our colleagues at the USGA serious concern. So, it's not a definitive statement, but again, between the lines, we got a problem, and we're going to address it. It's going to take some time, but I think your advocacy of this is something that'll have some influence too. So
I love his confidence.
Thank you, Brandon.
A pleasure. Pleasure.
Thank you. Until next time, everybody.
Doers
Lowe's, mowing season is here. With Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, you can get gas-like power with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower for just $329. With a runtime of nearly an hour, it's the perfect mower to tackle your half-acre lawn without a trip to the gas station. Just push and mow. Your grass won't wait, so buy it online and pick it up in-store to get out there sooner. Get gas-like power this spring with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower, just $329 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.